want to strive, to endeavor, and to go all out. That's what we call motivation, inspiration, and impetus. That's what happens when a student encounters the Vaughan Method.
Una clase de inglés Vaughan no es igual que las otras clases de inglés. En una clase de inglés Vaughan, el tiempo se optimiza al máximo. Cada minuto cuenta para tu empresa y cada minuto cuenta para tu inglés. Es una cuestión de pura matemática. Cuanto más practiques las estructuras esenciales del idioma, más confianza tendrás al usarlas en la vida real y más eficaz serás comunicándote en inglés. En este mundo globalizado, comunicar con eficacia es un sine qua non del éxito. A través de las clases presenciales o clases de videoconferencia, Vaughan hará que marques la diferencia para tu empresa.
Más información en Barcelona en el 933398687, en Madrid en el 911335831.
Sí, dígame.
Ahora tu profesor Vaughan, desde tu casa, la oficina. Tu profesor Vaughan en clases telefónicas. Ahora más fácil y cómodo. Consigue uno de los tres planes de formación en grupovaughan.com/clases telefónicas. Este año quiero recomendarte nuestro programa de formación más completo y potente que multiplicará tus oportunidades. Seguro que has oído hablar de él. Es nuestro máster en inglés profesional. Además, lo tienes disponible en todos los horarios, mañanas, tardes o fin de semana. La próxima convocatoria está ya muy cerca y, como siempre, a estas alturas ya son pocas las plazas que quedan. Si este año quieres ver un cambio significativo en tu inglés, esta es la mejor opción. ¿Por qué no reservas tu cita para hacer tu prueba de nivel? Sin compromiso, llámanos 911-133-5833. Toma nota. 911-133-5833. Sin duda, podemos asegurarte que realizando el esfuerzo y dedicación necesaria, avanzarás muy notablemente con el dominio del inglés y te sentirás cómodo o cómoda en cualquier ámbito, tanto profesional como personal. Ven a hacer tu prueba de nivel. Sin compromiso, tu prueba de nivel gratis. Llámanos 911-133-5833. 911-133-5833.
Gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams. And on tonight's program, I'd like to talk about what was happening in Spain during the early Carlist Wars. On my last program, I talked about the end of the Napoleonic Wars and what in English we call the aftermath. Aftermath is, it's a very old word. It's frequently used in journalism. One of the great words of journalism, the aftermath is el resultado de los acontecimientos. And math, although we don't use it anymore, math in Old English was la siega. And the aftermath sería como el rastrojo, ¿no? The stubble that is left after a grain harvest. As I say, that is the etymology. That is the origin of the term. And nobody knows this. So, yes, you hear the word aftermath, and, yeah, las consecuencias de un acontecimiento. Sort of like the situation after the smoke clears from a battlefield. And, yes, I was talking about the aftermath of the Napoleonic invasion and the curious
parallelism and family connections between las guerras carlistas in Spain and la guerra miguelista in Portugal. Carlos and Miguel are family. Miguel is Carlos's nephew. Miguel's mother, Carlota Joaquina, just as nasty and vicious and unscrupulous as her brother, Fernando VII, el rey felón. Carlota marries the Portuguese king, has a son, and actually two sons, four daughters. One of the sons, Miguel, and all four of the daughters are addicted to power and born conspirators and absolutists who believe that constitutions are illegal, immoral, ungodly. And so one of the daughters, Maria Francesca, gets married to none other than Carlos in Spain. She marries her uncle. She takes his sister with her to Spain, and immediately they begin to conspire with a group calling themselves the Apostolicos to try and institute the strictest and most severe regime of absolute royal and ecclesiastical authority in the face of the possibility that the new child, Isabel, the future Isabel II, the so-called Niña de la Constitución, is going to transform Spain into something liberal. And as I said on my last program, these people were invited to leave, right? The two Portuguese girls and, well, Fernando's brother Carlos are told to go to Portugal and not come back. And yes, Carlota Joaquina and her son, Miguel, sending people to Angola, executing people on a daily basis, establishing themselves. But then the real king, Pedro, forced to abdicate, then goes to London, and there, in London, finds exiles and finance that is going to help him take back the country. The result is the War of the Two Brothers, and Portugal comes out of this as a constitutional monarchy with a queen, Maria da Glória, aged 15, and a huge reaction against the church with the abolition of religious orders, with confiscation, with the sale of property. And we're going to see an absolute parallel in Spain, obviously, with the Carlist Wars and, of course, Mendizábal. So let's focus on Carlos, on what he was doing. He was in Portugal, and he was participating in that civil war. As I say, the Miguelistas were finally defeated in 1834, and Carlos escaped where? He couldn't go back to Spain. He couldn't stay in Portugal. Where do you think he's going to go? There's really only one place, London. And there, the government that did not like Miguel does not like Carlos either. And they offer him a very generous amount of money if he will simply renounce his claim to the throne and never go back either to Spain or to Portugal. And Carlos refused. He understood that he would get a more sympathetic audience in France. You have to remember that the Bourbons had been reinstalled, right? Louis the 18th was going to be able to give him moral support. Very quickly after that, he was in Elizondo, in Navarra. Now, of course, Maria Cristina le quería gobernar. She, as regent, issued a decree that deprived him of all of his rights
as an infante. And naturally, the Cortes confirmed this, and he decided to fight. And the fight was exceptionally bloody and exceptionally debilitating for Spain. This was Spain's first big revolt since the Comuneros. And it is going to mark the entire 19th century, which everyone considered to be a tragedy for Spain. Some historians have called the Spanish Civil War La Cuarta Guerra Carlista, because many of the things had never been resolved in the 19th century. And there were plenty of people with everything to lose, with the idea of modernism or the transformation or change in general. Remember that we have already seen how, as a result of the Napoleonic Wars, being a reactionary in Spain at this time was equated to being a patriot, whereas being a liberal was, you know, like in the case of the Afrancesados, a kind of sedition, a kind of treason to one's country. In other words, there were many people convinced that you would never find a patriotic liberal. And as I say, that's going to continue along the 19th century and deep into the 20th century as well. So the peasants had everything to lose at this point, right? Campesinos, especially in the north, ultra-conservative monarchists, and of course, members of the clergy, who had no problem killing their enemies in cold blood. Carlos, who was already there in Navarra, went from there to Guernica, where he swore under the oak tree, Guernicaco Arbola, that he was going to uphold and respect all of the fueros viejos. And this is where you get the origin of this idea of Viva Cristo Rey and the naming of, Our Lady of the Sorrows, Nuestra Señora de los Dolores, as the Generalissimo. And there were 6 years subsequently of war, and at a time when Spain really couldn't afford it. I mean, in Portugal, it was all over relatively quickly. The Miguelistas were defeated. As I say, the people in Oporto will tell you that this was Oporto in triumph against Lisbon. And you had thousands of lives lost, but in Spain, it was tens of thousands. Actually, 140,000 lives lost. And unforgettable things like the, as I say, the priests calling themselves Ángeles Exterminadores. You can imagine the kind of anti-clericalism that this is going to engender. And then, of course, Zumalacárregui. I think the first time I heard that, it was Esdrújula, no? But then, subsequently, you know, it doesn't have an accent. It doesn't have a diacritical accent, so that it must be Zumalacárregui, who became a folk hero all around the world just because of his red beret and because of his goatskin cape. I mean, in the 19th century, this would have been as characteristic as Superman or Spider-Man. Now, this was another Guerra de Guerrillas, right? The almost 100% of the standard military was loyal to Isabel. As I say, in English, we call her Isabella. But the rest of Spain had just come out of a Guerra de Guerrillas. And as I say, guerrilla war is a term invented in Spain and propagated all over the world. Like the word liberal, it is Spain's gift to the world. Like the word macho as well, people all over the world know what that word means. And yes, I suppose there's a reason. The Guerra de Guerrillas, the Napoleonic War had created this. And so by the time of the Carlist War, these techniques have been largely perfected. As I say, there was an anti-clerical reaction in Madrid. For example, in Madrid, there was cholera. As I say, cholera is something new, something typical of the 19th century. But the Madrileños decided that the reason Madrid was suffering and that people were dying is because the priests were putting poison into the water supply. I mean, it's very difficult to imagine the level of paranoia that would induce somebody to say something like this. But many, many people believed that the rumor was true. And as a result, they went out and killed about 70 priests in Madrid, far, far away from the battlefield. Now, the rest of Europe was highly entertained by this. After the Napoleonic Wars, you got a large group of people who had seen action in a wide variety of places, who were now kind of mobile, and who were no longer able to dedicate themselves to military life or, in the kind of depression that you always get after a big war like this. It was just a question of what to do. And it is no coincidence that all of the great explorations take place at this time, right? People going into Africa, people going into remote places in Asia. Descriptions of exotic places, travel literature, my life with the Eskimos. Many, many of these people were veterans of the Napoleonic War who kind of had to reinvent themselves afterwards. And for these people, the Carlist War was a magnet. All of a sudden you had, journalism, international journalism, practically reinvented at this time just to give people a taste of this conflict. Lots of people got involved. There was an Irish aristocrat who had a yacht, and he sailed his yacht into Malaga Harbor and captured Malaga in the name of Don Carlos and the Carlists. This same young man became, later on, he became the Bishop of Dublin. And it was just about this time that Mendizábal appeared, a Basque businessman, sort of in the same vein as the people 50 years earlier who had founded the Sociedades de Amigos del País and so forth. I mean, I could imagine Olavide and Mendizábal in conversation. On my last program, I talked about the land sales and how unfortunate the result was, the creation of Latifundia, the creation of landless peasants because of the elimination of common lands, because up until that time, las dehesas were generally considered common lands. I mean, every law has unintended consequences. We have seen this very recently with the all of the mutual accusations and so forth regarding CSC. And it is true that lawmakers are supposed to be able to see clearly enough into the future to be able to minimize those unintended consequences. But even the best written law will create unanticipated changes in the status quo. But nothing like the desamortización in this case. It condemned so many thousands of people to misery. It was more damaging to Spanish artistic and cultural heritage than any war could possibly have been. And as a result, the biggest single transfer of property in the history of Spain since the Reconquista resulted in no reform whatsoever. No, it just made the situation worse than it had been before. And you can imagine the people in Andalusia are looking back on the collective rights, you know, from the use of common lands, how that would have helped the creation of anarchism, the foment of anarchism among them, and the central idea that they had in the 19th and 20th centuries of el reparto, right? A land distribution, that the land belongs, rightfully belongs, to the person who works it. This, of course, is perfectly understandable in the United States. But again, in the United States, the land was taken away from the Indians before being made available to the people who worked it. And, other things. Distribution, the breaking up of Spanish land into provinces. This had been done earlier in France, and Spain decided to do it along French lines. Under Napoleon, that was all going to be different. Under Napoleon, it was all done according to water. So you had mountainous regions, and you had river valleys, and the logic was entirely geographic. But there was a kind of logic there. In any case, this proposal was never instituted. And so in, 1833, when they created the provinces, you can imagine it caused much more surprise than anything subsequent. Okay, if you go back and read some of the things from the late 1970s and the early 80s, when you had the creation of the autonomous communities, and how shocking it was for many people, and how anti-historical it was for many people. Say that Castilla la Vieja, right, the new Castilla León, would not have access to the sea through Cantabria, considered entirely ahistorical, as if Spain were turning its back on its own history. People writing at the time saying there is nothing more castellano than Cantabria, or other people surprised that Albacete should be part of Castilla-La Mancha, or even the name Castilla-La Mancha instead of Castilla-La Nueva. But Albacete, which had always been the hinterland of Murcia, directly connected in terms of history, in terms of economic ties, and now making it into a kind of junior partner in the five provinces of Castilla-La Mancha, and creating a Murcia all there by itself, too small to actually be economically self-sufficient. In any case, lots and lots of ink was put on paper because of the shock of the creation of the 17 autonomous communities. Oh, you can imagine what people thought when these provinces were created. I mean, previously, you would have little bubbles of one province located in another province, sort of like today, the Rincón de Amuz. But I'm talking about hundreds, hundreds of little bubbles that that belonged to other provinces. All of this, again, all of this a source of surprise and shock and regional reaction. So that from this time, you get the idea that that Madrid is actually the enemy, and that Madrid is working in its own interest against the common good and against local interests. And of course, you could make this case not just in when the reforms are obvious. You can make the case that these changes destroy traditions that should be honored and maintained. But you can equally make the case that these so-called reforms are repressing initiatives that the central government thinks might make the local authority too strong. And yes, In the end, it was, well, the Carlists wanted to come to Madrid, but they didn't. They could have. Madrid was practically undefended at that point, but they didn't quite get there. They lost the war, but they never really could have won it in the first place. They could have done a lot more damage than they did, however. And so, yes, you had the embrace of Vergara to symbolize in a kind of operatic way that it was all over and that nobody at this point was contesting that Isabel II was Spain's legitimate queen. And Don Carlo and several thousand of his followers went to France. Okay, I have to take a break. I'll be back in just a minute with the second part of the program.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a lot of new books that I think you will like, but there is one that you really should have, in my opinion. The title of the book is very simple, English Grammar. Yes, English Grammar. 470 pages of English Grammar. It's the best English grammar book on the market. For me, it's the best English grammar book in the world. The author, Claudia Martinez, is a veteran Vaughan teacher and a technical expert in our editorial department. And she has followed the spirit and the rigorous clarity that I have personally emphasized in the Vaughan Method for more than 40 years. This book, English Grammar, is the definitive guide to how we speak and how we construct our language today. As always, it's designed for Spanish speakers, hispanohablantes. In the book, we explain how and why. But we explain it in Spanish first, and then we give you many examples in English. We show you the structures, and often we compare them to the equivalent structures in Spanish. At the same time, we warn you, os advertimos, of many of the typical mistakes, sometimes important mistakes, that Spanish speakers often make. English Grammar, you can buy it in bookshops, large and small, in department stores, on Amazon, in Baugantiendo online, and on many other platforms. This book is for you. It's for your children. And it's for your grandchildren. This book will last for 100 years. There's no better Christmas or birthday present. English Grammar.
Yo en mi caso me lancé a hacer el máster porque en mi trabajo necesitaba hacer presentaciones en inglés, necesitaba hablar mucho en inglés, incluso por teléfono. Entonces fue la razón principal por la que me lancé a hacerlo, para tener una fluidez alta en el idioma y además hacerlo con seguridad.
Tengo grandes problemas a la hora de hablar. Me puedo comunicar perfectamente, pero no hablo de una manera correcta. Y también cosas muy importantes, como el poder hablar en público sin tener que tener ese miedo o ese vacío a la hora de decir qué hago ahora o qué digo. Con el máster he solucionado ese tipo de problemas, la verdad.
Yo lo que más destacaría del máster serían los profesores. Ellos son unos grandes profesionales, te motivan muchísimo con el inglés. Por supuesto, los materiales exclusivos que tenemos en el programa.
No estás como en una clase típica cogiendo apuntes, escribiendo. Lo trabajas hablando, y eso es muy complicado, porque coger una frase y de repente tener que hacerla en interrogativa, en negativa, cuando no lo tienes delante, ayuda a que tu agilidad verbal y tu capacidad también con el idioma sea cada vez mayor, porque es un reto.
Una de las partes que más me gustó del programa fueron las presentaciones a las que me tenía que enfrentar prácticamente cada semana. Otra de las cosas que más me gustó del máster fueron los dos Vaughan Town a los que asistí, porque esas experiencias eran siempre inolvidables y es una manera de darle un empujón importante al inglés.
Ya lo has oído, apúntate al máster de inglés profesional, ahora por videoconferencia. La misma calidad e intensidad, pero sin perder tiempo en desplazamientos. Entra en grupovaughan.com e infórmate.
Un futuro repleto de oportunidades. Un futuro con el máster en inglés profesional de Vaughan. El máster más completo, exigente, eficaz y con la garantía del líder en formación con más de 40 años de experiencia. Llama ahora al 911-33-5833. 911-33-5833.
If you spend 6 days in Vaughntown, you'll never be afraid to express yourself in English again. You will never feel insecure when you speak. This change, this psychological transformation happens in 6 days. It never happens in the classroom. The teacher in the classroom focuses on structure and oral practice. Vaughntown gives you wings. Te da alas.
La verdad que ha sido una experiencia increíble, sobre todo, bueno, las personas de ceremonias, tanto Carmen como Carlota, el feedback que hemos tenido con ellas, luego el buen ambiente que hemos tenido con todos los grupos, tanto las personas anglosajonas como los compañeros españoles, y luego la inmersión y la intensidad que hemos tenido ha sido siempre de una manera constructiva.
He venido sola sin mis compañeros, lo que a priori me daba un poquillo de angustia, porque claro, vienes sola, eres un poquillo tímida, qué sé yo, pero después tú llegas aquí y la verdad que aquí toda la gente como que intenta todo el mundo de ayudarte, todo el mundo es muy amable. Además descubres eso, que hay valores como internacionales, la solidaridad, el ayudarse el uno al otro. No sé, la verdad que está siendo interesante y luego creo eso, que hemos mejorado un montón, por lo menos en mi caso, a la hora de escuchar, más que en hablar, en escuchar. Porque muchas veces eso, hay muchos acentos diferentes, el hecho de poder identificar cada uno y escuchándole está interesante.
Venga a Vaughan Town, conozca lo que el pueblo anglo de Vaughan puede hacer por su inglés en tan solo 6 días. Llámenos al 911-33-5833, 911-33-5833 y viva la experiencia Vaughan Town.
Don Quijote y Sancho Panza, Cleopatra y Marco Antonio, Adán y Eva, Romeo y Julieta, Vaughan y Disney. ¿Eh?
Sí, ya lo has oído. Vaughan y Disney siguen colaborando para que tus hijos aprendan inglés mientras se divierten. La magia de Disney con la calidad de Vaughan. Entra en grupovaughan.com e infórmate.
If you are a mother or father, one of your most important responsibilities is to make sure that your children reach adulthood with a very strong command of English. Very strong. If you don't follow through on this responsibility, then your children will encounter many obstacles in the job market. They will not be attractive in the market. Between the age of 22 and 32, mastery of English is more important than anything else in order to find a job and in order to move up in an organization. It's more important than a university degree, a master's degree, or even a doctorate. English. After age 32, other skills and abilities become more important. But in the first 10 years, mastery of English is the king, and it will open doors right and left.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and on the first part of the program, I was talking about Carlists and the Carlist War, the first Carlist War in Spain, comparing that to what was happening in Portugal simultaneously, something very, very similar with the Miguelist War, which never, it was extremely unfortunate and damaging to Portugal, but not on the same scale. And at least for a while, the Portuguese Empire was still intact, whereas Spain was going to have to reinvent itself without access to its American colonies, except for Puerto Rico and Cuba. Well, over the course of the next couple of decades, Cuba is entirely transformed, and
you have large, large scale conversion to sugar plantations with the necessity to mobilize enormous amounts of slave labor. While slave labor is being phased out pretty much all over the world, in Cuba, also in Brazil, the 19th century is going to see its reinforcement and an insatiable demand for African slaves. And one of the things that's noteworthy in Cuban culture and also in Brazilian culture is that the enormous numbers of slaves that came directly from Africa at this time, Negros Bozales, those who still had that African culture, that those languages, those who were not familiar, not acculturated with the Americas, you still have that heavy imprint in, say, popular religion, things like the Orishas in Cuba or Candomblé. And so, long after the abolition of slavery everywhere else, practically a generation after the abolition of slavery everywhere else, it's going to be very strong in both Cuba and in Brazil. And this is going to generate a lot of money. Certainly in the case of Cuba, a lot of money for Barcelona. And yes, there are very few people in Barcelona today that will try to connect that line between modernismo, right, the Catalan version of Art Nouveau, and enslaved African labor in Cuba. But the connection is there. I mean, look at the life of somebody like the El Marqués de Comillas, for example. But getting back to the year 1840 in Spain, there was a problem with the Queen Regent, Maria Cristina. At this point, they called her La Ladrona. She was into everything. She and her compinches, no, her amiguetes, her cronies, people like the Marqués de Salamanca, they would speculate in anything. They would do anything. They would use their connections, use coercion, use fraud. Anything was legitimate to get as much as they could, as quickly as they could. They say that when Maria Cristina ate in the royal palace, the servants afterwards would count the silverware. Now, in a case somewhat reminiscent of Godoy, she found the great love of her life, even once her husband was gone, once Fernando VII was gone. She was very young when they married, and she didn't have him around for that long. In any case, her eye fixed on one of her personal guards, if I remember correctly, the Alabardero. And yes, his name was Agustín Muñoz. And they were happy. They were happy together. He started wearing the ex-king's clothing, right? He started to go out. He was living where the king had been living. They began to call him Fernando VIII. She promoted him, made him el duque de Triánsares. If you go to Tarancón, you'll be able to see his palace. He was the son of a shopkeeper. He was, of humble origin, but they had how many children? 8 children, something like that. And so, she just kept, she didn't care, right? She didn't care what people thought. So she would have all of these, royal functions, talking to the public in general, talking to, military review, something like that, when she was visibly pregnant. And after a while, enough was enough. Earlier on, this was in another program, I was talking about pronunciamientos and how especially during the first half of the 19th century, they came at a depressingly regular frequency. Well, she and her cronies, right, sus amiguetes,
would think nothing of creating rumors in order to manipulate prices, and from there to be able to speculate. They were deeply involved in the slave trade, which Spain at that point had signed a treaty with England saying that it would not permit slave trafficking. And here the Queen Regent was investing in slave trafficking. And they also tried to get a monopoly on salt. And when you raise the price of salt, everybody feels the effects. It was universally unpopular. So Baldomero Espartero intervened, and he was one of those operatic sort of people, right? Larger than life, flamboyant, and very, very popular among his men. He was a ladies' man. There was a British general who talking about him, saying that he destroyed more sheets than shoe leather. And he told Maria Cristina she was unwanted. She said, I made you a count and I made you a duke, but I could not make you a gentleman. Now, unfortunately, with Espartero in office, he was very much a member of the Moderado party. Political parties were still kind of embryonic at this time, but there was a definite tendency, lobby, if you will, but the Moderados. Now, other parties, other tendencies had generals on their side as well. The conservatives had their general. The radical liberals had their general. And the Moderados had more than one. So that the Moderados, they got together with, it was Narváez and Serrano, and they simply got rid of Espartero 3 years later. Espartero, who had been kind of like a father figure to Isabel II, and all of a sudden she is a complete victim of politics. They did not know what to do after Espartero, so they put her on the throne. On my last program, I talked about what was happening in Portugal with Maria da Gloria as queen at age 15. But at least she had her father as regent. Now you've got Isabel II as queen at age 13. And, you know, she is not of age, but people say that she was never of age. She never matured. And she was always very pleasant and generous and good-hearted and easygoing. And it was just a question of who she was going to marry. Nobody liked the idea of her marrying somebody powerful, right? Everything was negative. If she married a Frenchman, if she married a German, an Austrian, if she married an Italian, that would involve Spain in all sorts of European conflicts that Spain really did not want to get into at that point. Marrying her to a commoner was out of the question. It would have to be somebody. And they looked around and they found the weakest possible candidate. It was her cousin, Francisco de Assis. And they detested each other. They simply detested each other on sight. And so this begins the entire series. I mentioned this on an earlier program, right? The a series of calumnies that you have about Isabel II. Now, let's imagine that they say that her husband, Francisco de Assis, was homosexual. And there are historians who say that there is proof of this. And they say that perhaps as a consequence, she was able to console herself in the arms of many different lovers. And this is also practically irrefutable, because I certainly have never read any historian who disputes the idea, although many argue over who, when, how many, but the let's call it the indignation in Spanish historiography is how to characterize this, because I've heard so many negative things said about her, que tenía furor uterino, que era lasciva y guarra y soez, all sorts of judgment about what she was doing. Whereas recently there have been people who speak about her as a woman who knew her own mind, who was assertive, who in our days, in the 21st century, would have access to Tinder. But yes, historians all over are quick to judge. And it does make a good story, right? Especially when you're talking to people without a lot of interest or background in the 19th century, because the 19th century in Spain is very confusing. And so confusing and so depressing in its own way that it is rarely taught in school. As Francisco Franco once said, the 19th century is the worst thing that ever happened to Spain, y ojalá nunca hubiera pasado. And in Francoist times, you don't hear a lot about the 19th century that continued. And whereas in our time, historians love to write about the 19th century, and you go to a large bookstore to the history section, and you will see a great deal written about the 19th century. The people who consume those books and actually knows them something are a real minority of the general Spanish population. Although, who knows, if you go by statistics, they say that 50% of the Spanish population does not read even one book per year. And Spain, very much like the rest of the world, people who read for pleasure are reading more and more because book sales increase. Whereas people who used to read on a regular basis, newspapers and so forth, are reading less and less. But going back to the 19th century, it is for the vast majority of the population, simply a question mark. But if you want to understand the times of Isabel II, between 1843, when she was crowned, and 1868, when she was asked to leave, at, if I remember correctly, she was only, 38 years old at the time? But yes, if you want to understand this, you can do it. You can do it by looking at three different generals. Espartero, who I have already mentioned, Narváez, and O'Donnell. And Narváez being an arch-conservative, sort of a señorito Andaluz. He was prime minister five times in the 20 years that he was in power. He loved power. He loved having power. And he did not tolerate opposition. To Narváez, any opposition was insubordination. He had no trust in the democratic system, and so consistently used voter fraud in order to remain in power. The only way to get Narváez out of power, then, would be a pronunciamiento. They say that when he was on his deathbed, right, lecho de muerte, they asked Narváez if he forgave his enemies. This is one of the most common stories they tell about Narváez, that, you know, the priest comes there with the extreme unction and absolution and so forth, and he say, do you forgive your enemies? And Narváez said, I don't have any enemies, Father. Los he mandado a fusilar a todos. I had them all shot. Narváez believed in law and order. He was responsible for creating the Guardia Civil. And this was a benchmarking. They adopted the French system where these people could not be local. And the Guardia Civil were actively discouraged from going local. In other words, you did not want a Guardia Civil setting down roots, establishing himself in the community that he was supposed to be policing. And that meant a certain adversarial relationship between the Guardia Civil and the local population. But at the same time, it practically eliminates the possibility of corruption. There will not be any attempt to coerce or to bribe if these people are isolated and separated from, as I say, the local population and the criminal element in the local population. Under Narvaez as well, the state apparatus was at the service of, say, latifundistas or factory owners. Now, in the meantime, Spain became known as a travel destination. All sorts of outsiders writing about Spain and how Spain sort of epitomized this romantic idea that you can get a direct connection with the past, a direct connection with this timelessness, the way things used to be, the way they have always been. And you've got all sorts of people coming in, writing. Washington Irving, for example, attached to the American embassy, using diplomatic connections and so forth, establishing himself in Granada and writing the tales of the Alhambra, and thousands of people reading it and wanting the same experience when they come to Spain. Now, there were all sorts of people who came to Spain who saw, who really made an effort to classify, describe, and clarify the essence of Spain. This involved a lot of research. It involved a lot, you know, going into the archives, things that a lot of Spanish people had not done previously. These were done by outsiders. The other day at the El Museo de Artes Decorativos in La Calle Montalbán, right next to the Palacio de Comunicaciones, well, just up the block toward the Retiro, there was a talk about coleccionismo and foreign collections, Spanish collections. And one of the speakers there was saying that a lot of these foreigners had come in and done the best they could in certain aspects of, say, decorative arts, like ceramics, textiles, painting, furniture. And they had done their initial research. They had come to their conclusions, and they had ended up convincing Spaniards that that this is what Spain was, that this was the essence of Spain. And, you know, it's only much later, actually in the 21st century, that people are starting to go back to the sources and reevaluate and sort of do the homework to, in many cases, overcome the clichés. But again, going back to the times of Isabel, the contrast with Portugal could not be more stark. Maria da Gloria, she died in 1858, giving birth to her 10th child. Her husband was cousin to Prince Albert, right? Her husband was the cousin of Queen Victoria's husband, the Duke of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha, and he had received offers all over from Greece, and you know, they were even thinking about marrying him at one point to Isabel II, but again, that was considered too binding, right? Vinculante, como lioso. But just as his cousin was busy doing in England, there were all sorts of reforms and good government and education and female education in Portugal before Spain. The cork industry, the textile industry, ceramics, glass, the death penalty was abolished. Slavery was abolished. Now, of course, by this time, Brazil was independent. In fact, there was a lot of bad blood bad blood between Brazil and Portugal. There had been a mutiny in the Brazilian Navy, and so the Portuguese Navy transported 600 people to Buenos Aires rather than let them, you know, fall victim to the repression in Brazil. And Brazil reacted to this by simply cutting off economic ties to Portugal. This hurt the Portuguese economy very, very badly. No market for their products, but also no remittances, no remessas. At this point, there were all sorts of Portuguese people living and working in Brazil, and they were not able to send money home to their families. The result was very much a disaster. But still, the country was at least being governed fairly well. As I say, totally unlike what was happening in Spain. But I will have to talk about that on my next program.
Tengo 23 años y acabo de terminar la carrera de Administración y Dirección de Empresas. Decidí hacer este máster antes de acabar la carrera porque mi nivel de inglés era realmente bajo. Veía que tenía que buscar un trabajo y que necesitaba un buen nivel de inglés. Y creí que esta era la mejor forma y una alternativa a irte fuera. Así que decidí compaginar un poco los estudios con el inglés. Y ahora que he terminado, hace una semana que he terminado los estudios, si tengo que buscar trabajo, me siento un poco más preparada. Lo mejor es el equipo de profesores que tienen. Hacen las clases muy amenas y aprovechamos el tiempo al máximo.
No importa lo que hayas estudiado, no importa a qué te quieras dedicar. Hagas lo que hagas, vas a necesitar el inglés. Haz un máster que realmente merezca la pena. Haz el máster en inglés profesional de Vaughan. Más información en el 91 133